have a neighbor that recently won $100,000 over at Bunny's playing the lottery. What if she had won 10 million? We see those kinds of numbers. And it's actually quite possible. We're surrounded by millionaires here, just in this community of Manchester and Bedford. What would you do if you had as much as you can possibly imagine? Well, this is exactly what Koheleth, the preacher, or Q, is telling us to do. He's asking us, as it were, to come along on a journey with him. And he is elevating his experience to such a height that we cannot imagine being wealthier or more successful or having more enjoyment in this world than he is inviting us to enjoy with him. And he's looking at it with a sharp eye. He's looking at it from the viewpoint of wisdom. And he's seeking to learn something from all of this experience under the sun. And he wants us to share in what he is learning. These are very difficult verses, brothers and sisters, to understand until we begin to get real about what the text is actually saying and not worry so much about trying to coordinate it with other things until we, first of all, understand what the text itself is actually saying. It seems to me that it's saying life can be really good and we can enjoy things. Yes, we smile. And then on the other hand, when we realize that whether you're wise or foolish, you all die, I hate life. It really stinks today. And we might stand back and say, he's either a liberal or he's a cynic. He's really gotten kind of bitten by a nasty attitude towards life. When in fact, what we ought to say is that wisdom, having gone with him, accompanied him on his journey, and the text says that in several places, is actually giving a true perspective on the world. And this ought to help us because, in fact, it is precisely our experience, isn't it? One day we get the rewards of our labors and life seems to be so good, and the next day something awful hits us, whether it's a big debt or cancer or some broken relationship, then life that day doesn't feel so good at all. And we, of course, as Christians, see both of those experiences through the lens of redemption, through the lens of Christ. But though it changes our attitude toward the experience itself remains quite the same. And to me, this was a great comfort to discover the realism with which Ecclesiastes faces life in a fallen world. Life as it is experienced by believer and unbeliever alike. The difference is that beyond the grave, we have hope. And so let's look at these words then in a little bit of detail as we take it apart, verses 1 to 11, 12 to 16, and then 17 is a conclusion both to the text and to the sermon. But the first thing is that he goes on this quest, it's a purposeful quest, to seek satisfaction in the pleasures of this world. It's the pursuit of pleasure. It's the pursuit of enjoyment. And he says this. He said, I said of laughter, he says, I will test you with mirth. And if you look in your margin, you'll see that the word is gladness. It's a very nice word. It's a very good word. It's the kind of thing that we feel when we enjoy anything in God's creation. And so he's testing his heart now with various earthly pleasures. And of course, the great question that we ask as Christians immediately, and it's a good question to ask, is this sinful? Is he talking about sinful pleasures? And it's a question that I think commentators have answered in quite different ways. And I think probably the first time I read through it, I thought, yep, he's given himself to pleasure. He's drinking too much. He's eating too much. He's gathering wealth and worshiping it. And that's the thing that he's experiencing, and it brings him to see that it's really futile. But I don't think this is what's happening here at all. If you look honestly at the list of pleasures, and I have five basic categories here, we have this. We have cheerfulness in dining and enjoying good wine. We have home and garden enjoyment. We have servants and animals. We have great wealth. And we have music. These don't sound sinful to me. Of course, each of them can be enjoyed in a sinful way. I don't think that's at all what he's saying. He's saying, let's look at these things now in God's world, these legitimate pleasures, and let's analyze them and let's see if they bring any kind of ultimate satisfaction. Remember that that's what it means here when he says pleasure. It's satisfaction. It's not just temporary enjoyment, but he's looking to see if there is any real satisfaction, any lasting value in the joy that he experiences in these temporal pleasures. And wine and mirth, this sounds like just ordinary conviviality. That's a good word. It's when people get together and enjoy themselves. It's what happens when people are married and we have a wedding feast. That's what he's talking about here. And in fact, there's no hint that there's drunkenness. He probably was a man who enjoyed the various vintages of wine that the garden that God provided for him had given him. And in fact, it reminds us a little bit, doesn't it, of the picture that we have of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. They're surrounded by trees, fruits of all kinds, which certainly would have included grapes, vineyards. They enjoyed the world that he gave them. And then even more now to the point is home and garden. If you look in verses 4 through 6, you see that in home and garden now, he's enjoying himself to the full. And I want you to notice this word for orchards here in, see what it has in this. Yeah, this is the same as mine at home. Sometimes this New King James in the pulpit is slightly different than the one that I study from at home. But here it is, orchards in verse 5 is the same word for paradise. It's the word that comes from an ancient Persian word, which is the same exact word for our word, paradise, paradiso. And it's the same in each language. It comes from an ancient Persian word, and it refers to those royal pleasure gardens. If you've ever been to a great mansion and seen the beautiful gardens, I know Winterthur down in Delaware is that way. It's something like a 50-room mansion. And you could go just to see the gardens because they're extensive. There are pools and miniature palaces and places to sit and plants and flowers of every kind that you can imagine. And it's gorgeous. It's God's gift. It's paradise. And in fact, the walled garden is exactly a picture of the Garden of Eden. It was a place that God had placed man to enjoy. It was a home for him, a place to cultivate, a place to experience the pleasure that the writer here, Q, is reminding us he enjoyed to the full. And then servants and animals, livestock of all kinds. If you ever go, I hope you always get a chance to go to one of the fairs that we have here in New England. We happen to like the Deerfield precisely because it has lots of plants and animals and vegetables. It's loaded with all kinds of things that kids and parents grow throughout the year, and you get to see them, and they're wonderful. They give praise to God because they are his creation. And then great wealth of silver and gold in verse 8. Remember that back in the Garden of Eden, there were precious gems and silver and gold. And then music and musical instruments, the enjoyment of culture. Music is one of the chief pleasures of life. And he enjoyed this to the full. He had his own choirs and his own orchestra, as it were. And he enjoyed all of these things. And I submit to you, brothers and sisters, that these are not in themselves sinful things. In this passage, I know that you don't think they're sinful, period, but he's not saying, oh, he engaged in sin, a life of sinful pleasure, and look what happened to him. He found out it was an empty life. Well, that's true, but it's not what this text is saying. In fact, he's saying quite the opposite of that. He's saying all of these legitimate God-given pleasures still left me missing something. Still left me without an ultimate sense of satisfaction. Listen to what it says of Solomon in 1 Kings 4. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, some of which presumably we have in the book of Proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. Also, he spoke of trees, from the cedar trees of Lebanon, even to the hyssop that springs out of the wall. He spoke also of animals, of birds, of creeping things, and of fish. He enjoyed them. And it's no accident then that, and we read this in a slightly different context, but the point is really the same. When Paul exhorts Timothy, and he says, exhort the rich now, command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty, nor to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God, who gives us richly all things to enjoy. See what he's saying there? It's a trusting in them. It's seeking to find ultimate satisfaction in them. That's the problem. The things themselves are good. They're God's creation. He gave them to us to enjoy. And so, in fact, he comes to just this conclusion. Before he says it's vanity, notice in verses 9 and 10, he says this was his reward. He had more than anyone before him. So he's saying, I've got more than you can imagine. And then he says, I looked on all the works that my hands had done and on the labor in which I had toiled. And indeed, back in verse 10, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward or my portion from all my labor. He rejoiced. It wasn't sinful. It's the kind of thing that we experience in our lives on a regular basis. It's part of life. And then he goes and comes to an opposite conclusion. Now, he does it by backing up, as it were. See, he's carried wisdom with him all along the way. Remember back in verse 3, he said, I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom and how to lay hold on folly. So while he was doing all of this, the word gratify, I don't think, would have been the best translation, to enjoy or strengthen, make cheerful my flesh with wine, but while guiding my heart with wisdom. So he's looking for wisdom in his experience. He comes then to the conclusion in verse 11 that it is indeed vanity. That is to say, that things are out of whack. And the reason he concludes this is because of what he's about to say in the next several verses. And I want you to back up a second now and look at this in terms of the structure. If you look where in verse 11 he says, then I looked, it's too bad they didn't translate it this way, because in the original it's the exact same word. Then I turned myself, verse 12 and verse 11 should begin with exactly the same phrase. Then I turned myself. And what the writer is doing here is he's creating a hinge for us here. He's gone from the general statement that all is vanity, and then he said, but look at these great pleasures. I've searched them out, and I found that there is a joy, a pleasure in them that's legitimate. But then he says, now I turned, and I considered these things. And then he says the same thing again in verse 12, and now he's going to ask if wisdom itself, if his own reflection on the goodness of God's creation, if wisdom itself is satisfying, will wisdom be satisfying as opposed to folly? So I turned myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly. And actually, you might want to translate madness and folly, the irrationality of foolishness. They're not two separate things, but it's a Hebrew parallelism where there's a repetition, madness and folly, the irrationality of that which is foolish, and he came to consider these two things, wisdom and rationality, and to take a look now at these two things to see if wisdom is really excellent. And he concludes that it is. It excels folly. Who would choose folly when you can have wisdom? And he wrote 3,000 proverbs and 1,005 songs. Solomon had wisdom. He had so much wisdom that people came from all over the world to gather his insights into how to live and his insights observing the world that God had created us in and given us to enjoy. And so now he looks at that and he comes to the right conclusion. He says the wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. So darkness and light are the metaphors that he uses. And here, going really back to the creation, it was when lights flooded the universe, and then lights were set in the sky, the stars and the moon and the sun. These were superior. They, as it were, chased away the darkness, and darkness becomes a metaphor for folly and for sin, and ultimately for hell. And so he says, surely, the wise man's eyes are in his head. That is to say, he has a much clearer vision, a better way of understanding how to live. Sounds great. And then he comes to his sad conclusion that the same event happens to them all. The same event. And we know what that event is. It's death. So whether I'm wise or a fool, I'm dead. And in fact, you see this in the obituary columns. You see wise people and foolish people. They all seem to have been wonderful parents and brothers and sisters, I've noticed. That's the world's assessment of them, and I guess that's a happier thing to say than anything else in an obituary, which would be very inappropriate. But the fact is that we know that there are as many fools, perhaps more than wise people, in those obituary columns. And so what he's saying is absolutely true, and what's really discouraging is that you look and they're forgotten. Even someone like, how much can you tell me about one of the most famous people in the 20th century, Winston Churchill? There are probably a few of us who could spin a yarn for 20 or 30 minutes on Winston Churchill. Do we think about him very often? No. And he was the most famous of all. We forget people. We even forget those we love when they're gone from this world. And so he recognizes something that is truly, it truly brings you up short. T.S. Eliot and Thomas Gray wrote a couple of the greatest stanzas on death that I know of in the English language. In Whispers of Immortality, an interesting title, by the way, because Intimations of Immortality was Wordsworth's somewhat romantic view of immortality, as if everything says immortality. Eliot, being a 20th century poet, said, no, there are at best whispers of immortality through death. And if you read that poem, you'll see quite a picture, not a happy one. Webster was much possessed by death and saw the skull beneath the skin, and breastless creatures underground leaned backward with a lipless grin. And then Thomas Gray, in his elegy written in a country churchyard, the boast of heraldry, the pomp of power, and all that beauty, all that wealth e'er gave, awaits alike the inevitable hour. The paths of glory lead but to the grave. Summing up what Q says here, I think, quite nicely. All this glory that I have, and I see that wise or fool, rich or poor, we all die. We all go down into the dust. We end up precisely where the Lord said Adam would end up if he chose not to walk before my face, if he chose not to be ultimately loyal to me. Dust. And so what's the use? And then he comes to his conclusion, therefore I hated life, because the work that was done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and grasping for wind. Remember the definition of our word vanity, hebel. It's not only emptiness, which is certainly that's one aspect of hebel, but hebel means not the way it was designed to be. Hebel means out of whack. The original word, by the way, is breath or vapor. So it's something that you can see But if you grab it, it's gone. It's not really there. And it's frustrating. That's the point. It leads to frustration. It doesn't lead to ultimate satisfaction. And so he's saying, listen, I enjoy life. It's wonderful at times, and it's horrible at times. I hate it at times because I contemplate death, and I see what frustration there is built into my existence. What am I to make of this? And what we make of it, brothers and sisters, is that we live in a world under the common curse and under common blessing, or common grace, as it's called. I like to use a blessing, I think, because grace is being used a little bit too freely nowadays in different ways. But it is an unearned, undeserved favor of God's blessing, which is on all the world. His rain, the rain and the sun, all the good things in life are there for everyone, the believer and the unbeliever. And the bad news is, so are the bad things. They're there on the believer and the unbeliever. Pam Cook has cancer, and she may not live beyond the age of 55 or whatever. And this happens. And then there are people who are wicked as wicked can be. They live the most selfish lives, and they will get the Boston Post Road cane and live to 105. It's a crazy existence as we look at it from this perspective. It's out of whack. It's not the way God originally designed it to be. But guess what? He has designed it to be out of whack now so that we will turn to Him. It's out of whack so that we will recognize that what we need the most is the giver of the good things that we do enjoy legitimately. And so, people of God, we need to look through the perspective of the cross, or from the perspective of the cross, at the good and the bad in our lives. We need to look, as it were, above the perspective under the heavens. And the only way that we can do that, because remember that under the heavens, or under the sun, means under the wrath and curse of God, is through the cross. It's only as we understand that we need to be reconciled with the God who gave us the whole world and who is in sovereign control of it, that we can then really put these things in perspective. And we can trust the Lord to meet our temporal needs. The reason that people scramble around, as Jesus said in Matthew 6, trying to get all that they need in this life, is because they know that the world is under a curse. And if you don't scramble around, you might not make it. And what he's saying now is that the problem, of course, in life is that the relationship between heaven and earth is messed up. It's out of whack. And so I have allowed the world to be out of whack so that you'd turn to me and find satisfaction in me. And I have met the need that you have in the cross of Jesus Christ. In His cross, heaven and earth are reconciled. In His cross, there is an ultimate glory in which there will be no out of whack experience. Thank God for that. And the wackiness of life makes us long for it, doesn't it? It should. We tend to want to make everything so comfortable with our efficiency and everything else that we try to do to make life perfectly pleasant and safe and no problems at all. That's what the whole 21st century is all about. That's what modernity is all about, that we ignore this. But you know what? We can't. Because however many cures for different diseases, which we're happy for, there will never be a cure for death. And there will never be a cure for sin that men will find out. But there already is a cure for both sin and death in Christ, because the curse has been lifted. And I want to close now by reading several scriptures from Isaiah and Revelation. I'm going to mix them up. And I'm not going to tell you which ones are which. You can ask me afterwards. But I want you to get the whole drift now of what we're looking forward to. As you enjoy the blessings of God, you can remember that they are still a little taste, not only of the garden that we were exiled from, but the garden paradise that is yet to come in the resurrection of those who are saved by God's grace. Then I said, I have labored in vain. I have spent my strength for nothing and in vain. This is Messiah speaking in Isaiah. Yet surely my just reward is with the Lord and my work with my God. We frequently read that during the Lord's Supper. And then this, he who has ears, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give to eat from the tree of life, which is in the midst of the paradise of God. And there shall be no more curse, but the throne of God and the Lamb shall be in it, and his servants shall serve him. And then finally this, for behold, I create a new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered or come to mind, but be glad and rejoice forever in what I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem as a rejoicing and her people as a joy. I will rejoice in Jerusalem and joy in my people. The voice of weeping shall no longer be heard in her, nor the voice of crying. No more shall an infant from there live but a few days, nor an old man who has not fulfilled his days. For the child shall die 100 years old, but the sinner being 100 years old shall be accursed. They shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For as the days of a tree, so shall be the days of my people. And my elect shall long enjoy the work of their hands, and they shall not labor in vain, nor bring forth children for trouble. For they shall be the descendants of the blessed of the Lord and their offspring with them. And so there is paradise. There will be no more wackiness there.